interview with John Slocum, Herb Gordon, and Jim Ling. What I'm doing is collecting the recollections of people who were key individuals in the development, creation, development of Stony Brook. I'm not doing the writing, because I've got my own writing problems. And as you know, or you may not know, I came to Stony Brook in 62. First year that we moved out to Stony Brook campus. And I joined the system as executive dean in the Albany office on detail to Stony Brook for a year until they could find a president. And it took 3 years. Tom Hamilton, the week after I got there, Tom Hamilton said he was going to resign as of December 31st. And it took Frank Moore 18 months to find Sam Gould. I had been on the island at the Brookhaven National Laboratory from 47 to 52, and then I was out in the Middle West, and Buffalo came, joined the system in 62. So what I'm trying to do is see how Stony Brook got started. When did you join the system?
1952.
In 52. So you've been there for quite a while. And then let me ask you a couple of questions here that I think are relevant to what would be needed if someone to...
No, sure, they're right.
What was your position, John?
I came in as secretary to the board of trustees.
I see.
When I came in, there were no presidents acting. Charles Garside, who was a trustee, he was acting president. Carlson came in shortly after.
Shortly after. From Chicago?
No, University of Vermont.
Vermont, I see. Okay. How did the idea of starting something on Long Island arise?
Well, Long Island wasn't the prime consideration. The prime consideration was to start a college which would train science teachers and also would have engineering science.
Speak as loudly as you can.
The real impetus, I guess, came from the aftermath of Sputnik when everybody in this country began to realize how science teaching was kind of sad in the school system, and it meant that something had to be done in the way of better teaching in high school. You may remember that at this time, this was in the 50s, the private colleges in the state had been contending that they could take care of all possible higher education needs then and forever. And so they were effectively blocking the state university from any kind of expansion beyond the existing system, which then consisted of a group of teachers' colleges plus Harper, which we had inherited from the, and the contract colleges in kind of a loose. And at that time, Champlain College in Plattsburgh, which was an Air Force base, shortly to be closed as the Air Force took over again. So the board, Frank Moore's leadership, determined that we had to break through and get some new science teaching facilities along with some kind of engineering training. So the first consideration was the kind of program.
There was no engineering in the system at all at that time?
At that time, no. determination was to start this a new institution somewhere in the state, as yet unspecified, which would have these as a major. But the board made it very clear in their own deliberations that this was just to be the start, and that the institution would grow beyond that into a full-fledged center, such as you know I have. Now, I remember distinctly at the board meeting when Frank Moore, before he took the vote, went around and polled each member of the board to make it clear to them that this was to be eventually more than just science, teaching, and engineering, so there'd be no misconception as to what was planned.
This book was after Sputnik.
Yes.
So that would be 56 or 7.
I would guess. I don't remember the exact years.
Right.
But, I think that sounds about right.
Mid-50s. Yeah.
So with that clear understanding, the board unanimously decided on such a program to start in science education and engineering, and made the announcement. It was at this point that, unsolicited, Ward Melville sent a letter to Frank Moore saying he understood that the State University was interested in establishing a new college, and that he had a considerable amount of land on Long Island, which he thought might be suitable for such an institution, and he would be willing to give this to the university for that purpose.
Did he know Frank Moore then?
Out of the blue.
Is that right? I wonder how he heard about it.
In the press.
In the press. I see.
So Frank turned the letter over to me and said, go down and take a look. So I went down to visit Ward and Bayless. Steve was with me, and I don't know who else. Maybe Charlie Foster. Anyway, Bayless took us over the whole property, which is then about 400 acres or so. And we had lunch with Ward at the Three Village Inn, I remember. Beautiful day. And talked about it in general ways. The only concern that Ward had then and always, as I'm sure you remember,
right,
was the architectural style. And Ward was hoping, more than hoping, that he wanted to see a architectural style which would be harmonious to the whole Three Village Inn development.
Why do you suppose he made the gift?
I asked him that, and he said, well, I'm sure that if I don't do this, it will eventually be sold up into a whole lot of housing developments, and you'll have a slightly higher level leather town, but nevertheless an influx of simply bedroom housing, and he was anxious to make Stony Brook a cultural center, as well as avoid that kind of development. And of course, money was not the main object. He was anxious to keep the community, and this is in harmony with what he had done, and this is, of course, why he wanted the architectural style. This was always a sticking point, because while SUNY tried to make adjustments in design, we had to contend, of course, with the state architects and the Bureau of the Budget. Every time we wanted to do something to make it a little nicer, we had a big fight.
Who was the state architect?
I think it was Carl Larson at the time, I remember.
Larson?
I think so. And he was sympathetic, but again,
what about Otto Tegan?
No, he was a state university architect.
State university architect.
Carl Larson was the state architect.
I see.
And the state architect had, of course, the final say on plans. But beyond that, he couldn't tell the budget to do it. So Carl might approve a plan, but the budget office still had to sign off.
I see.
L. Stevens was basically involved with this. And Tegan. Well, Michigan was, of course, the state at the state university. Alan Stevens had the motion, was directly assigned to this at this point. I'm trying to get the sequence here. We then started checking out the location as to whether it would be a desirable site. I mentioned to you on the phone, it seemed to be a obvious population center, and one which was not served by the state university,
right,
except for Nassau Community College. So that the location seemed to be a very good one. At that time, one of our board members was head of the New York Telephone Company.
And was that Phelan?
No. Phelan was later. This was, Keith. Can't think of his name.
Keith McHugh.
Keith had his staff check out the growth projection because, of course, they were always doing this for the entire state, the phone company. And they felt also that this was probably the prime growth area and would be served by university. So, from that point, the trustees decided to accept the gift. But at the same time, and because it would take so long to develop it, and we wanted to have a staff in place planning for it, we decided to open a very small operation at Planning Field, which, as you know, belonged to the state university through a gift to Farmingdale from
William Robertson Cole had given
right
Planning Field in what, 55 or 6?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Before that, I think. The Farmingdale Institute had been working on that for many years before that, and then eventually Cole gave the entire state over to some kind of arrangement.
All right. Well, good morning, sir.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, how are you? See you. I've asked Bill Ed, well, he's home at 10:30. Bill Ed, I was at the and Jim Lane, who worked with me on when we back in the old land acquisition days.
All right.
I'm getting the earliest view.
He's getting the pre-land act.
Sure. Sure, I remember it very well. Why don't you come, go ahead?
Why don't we give us another 10 minutes?
Take as much time as you want.
All right. Yeah. 10 minutes. Can I get in touch?
Yeah.
Sure. All right.
Fine.
So the decision was then made at a board meeting.
One of my colleagues is out today. Why don't you use her office for a little while? That'll give me a chance to return a few phone calls before the others get here. If you don't mind.
Is this your company?
No.
It's a longer company.
You're welcome.
I don't need to.
You want.
All right. We were just deciding to open temporarily at Coe State.
Good.
With Lan Olson as the chief administrative officer. And the
position relating to Carlson.
Carlson,
oh, what was his position?
He was assistant dean for four-year colleges. At that time, we had a set up of four so-called executive deans.
Okay.
One for medical education, one for community colleges and two-year education, one for teacher education, and one for, she called the rest, which would be four-year colleges, Harper, Maritime, etc. They didn't want to put it under the teacher education rubric because of things developed into other things, including science education.
They knew that right along.
Oh, yeah. And so it was put under the jurisdiction of Froden, Reuben Froden, who was then the executive dean for four-year college. His assistant was Leonard Olson. Now, ever since the board decided on starting a program of this sort, Olson had been working on ideas for curriculum and so forth. But when it was decided to move ahead temporarily start Johnson was moved into the active directorship when I was called at that time. Chief administrative officer.
Right.
Down
there you go.
Okay, Atlantic Field. And he was at that time under Frozen's jurisdiction until Frozen left. At some point, I don't remember exactly when Harry Porter came in. And then Olson reported to Porter. By then, the administrative structure had changed somewhat, and I had then become chief administrative vice president, whatever that was called, and Porter was on the opposite side of the academic program, correct? So then became the academic program under Harry Porter. So Olson had two jobs, one to direct the planning for the global program, secondly, to administer the operation down there at the Postwick. He then started an intensive, this is before Porter came, Olson and I basically started an intensive look at engineering programs around the country to try to get an idea of A, what was needed, B, what was wrong with the program. And we visited, Charlie Foster was involved in this, all of us with contact. We visited engineering schools and the Bell Lab and whatnot. And the consensus was that most engineering programs, as we were then taught undergraduates, were not adequate for the changing state of the art. A lot of the people in corporations, the guy like Bell, was hiring nothing but PhDs, told us they would hire electronic engineers, PhDs, and then spend the year retraining them to bring them up to date. And the consensus seemed to be that what was needed was a good solid engineering science program from which they could then go into the specialty. And that engineering had been too fragmented,
too closely tied to the hardware.
Exactly. So we then directed the planners to look towards engineering science and to do science education.
Did it work with GE at all?
Yeah, the top GE. Yeah. I think the most helpful people probably were Bell Labs people who were one of the big innovators at the time and one of the big employers and who did subsidize, as you know, on a pure research. There was a certain amount of obvious jealousy on the part of other engineering schools to realize that those same schools were saddled with a program, with a problem, which was in building obsolescence.
Yes, right.
And one of the reasons we were able to attract some good people, I think, was that this was a chance to start with a fresh really developed. Well, about this time, then after that, I got out of the academic side of the business, so beyond that, back to the other aspect, we got this firm of Voorhees Walker to come in and do the general overall architectural planning and one of the buildings.
How did they come in? Because I've heard that there was a prior firm.
Yeah. That was an unfortunate.
Clark and Rapuano.
Right.
So anytime if you want to commit us up to you guys, I got Jim Ling in here.
Okay.
All right.
Want to go in now?
Sure. All right.
Once the gift had been accepted from Warden Elgo, then the next step, of course, was to develop a site plan. And here some misunderstanding arose. Otto Tiegen, as we said, was the state university architect. he asked Moore and Hutchins to develop an overall site plan. Moore and Hutchins had done the site plan and the design for buildings at Harper College, which was then called near Binghamton. The stipulation was that this was to be a site plan. And there is some controversy as to whether anything else was implied or promised. The contract did not. But Moore and Hutchins felt that they were going to be given some of the buildings. And it's true, that's quite common. You develop a site plan and you do some buildings, as they had done at Hopper. However, the board had been unhappy with the length of time that it had taken to develop the college at Binghamton. And also, with under Frank Moore's urging, and with the blessing of Governor Harriman and his special coordinator, I don't know what you call him, Colonel Burrell, who was, remember Colonel Burrell, I forget what
remember the name, that's all right.
Frank got a commitment from all of these that this was to be a fast operation and cut off a couple of years from what state you think of to build. It was felt also that Moore and Hutchins did not have the size shop to do this kind of an undertaking that fast, that big. And at this point, again, Keith McHugh mentioned the firm of Voorhees Walker, who had done a lot of work for the telephone company, and was a big firm. So I got in touch with Voorhees Walker, and I was then, you see, still directly under Frank Moore's direction. And of course, Frank, at that time, because of the fact that there had been frequent shifts in the presidency and times without, which are now called the chancellor, and because also, you remember, the Board of Trustees started the university with no chancellor, no president. So the board for a long time was a much stronger board than you have in, you know, usual university setup. And the presidents, right down through Hamilton until Gould, had a difficult time in asserting their prerogatives of office vis-a-vis the board.
Leadership.
Yeah. It was a very, very strong board. And Frank was the chairman for all this time until Gould came. Having talked with Voorhees Walker, then decided to engage them to do the original building, the first building that we put on the site. And it was at this time that Moore and Hutchins claimed that they had been,
sidetracked.
I guess pushed aside, you know. And they, however, since there was nothing in the contract about this, they brought an action to the American Architectural Institute, claiming that Voorhees Walker had unethically solicited a job whilst the contract was in the hands of another architect. And there was a hearing by the American Architectural Institute, since they were both board. And I, of course, participated, and since I've been the primary liaison with between the board and the architects, etc., I testified that Voorhees Walker had never solicited the job, but we had approached them. But to no avail, since they were given a slap on the wrist. That is, Voorhees Walker, 1 year suspension of membership. I would say that Moore and Hutchins were not too happy that the action was taken, one of the senior partners in that firm, whose nose was considerably out of joint, and I think with Otto Tegan's blessing, had insisted that the action be brought forward. So it was unfortunate. The partners, the other partners of Gordon Hutchins, were very excited about it. It wasn't that. It was fairly amicable, but the partner, one of the partners who felt very strongly about this, insisted that the action go forward. After that, then the main problem was in the design of the building. And Ford Melville, as you know, wanted to have the colonial Williamsburg look, or at least Dartmouth College.
Cedro or Georgian.
Yeah. And we got some concessions. I guess the closest building that Ward lacked was the, what was then the Central Library, I guess, for administration. The one with the big windows.
Well,
the first building was built there.
They built the library,
yeah.
But when I came in 62, we had three buildings.
Mm-hmm.
We had the humanities building.
Right.
We had the chemistry building.
Right.
Closest to the library, mm-hmm. for some unearthly reason. And we had the first group of dormitories.
It was the library building. It was...
And the library building was being built. But we couldn't move into it until the next year.
Well, the state did, the budget office did allow a few frills on the library building, but not much anything else. I think they gave us a copper roof, finally, for example, and a few things. But I understand they just named the library building for Ward, is that right?
No.
Some other
The building that was built all the way around the library,
mm-hmm.
when we were growing, the mandate has been changed to a university center.
I hadn't seen that building.
That is Banker Ward's father.
Oh.
So it's Frank Melville.
Thank you.
We've just named the Social and Behavioral Sciences building for Ward Melville.
Well, so, just to wrap it up, Lloyd Walker did the first round, and then by then I was not involved in that administration, and I think they got another architect for the... or others. Maybe Roy Walker did tell round two, I don't know. But,
I think DeMars, Bacorny, and Weigel were given student union.
Mm-hmm.
And, then, actually later, asked to supervise the whole campus. But there were other architects,
yeah.
that they had not brought in, who had different buildings.
Well, the result was, I think nobody was happy. Ward wasn't happy. Our architects weren't happy. Steve is not one of the leaders in the Williamsburg Dartmouth type buildings.
I remember those early drawings. All right.
So it was a compromise, which, as usual, satisfied nobody very much. But I think Ward, I guess, last time I talked to him, softened somewhat.
Yes, I think he understood that the concept of a small liberal arts college had been superseded, and that probably for the interest of the state as a whole, that was all to the good.
Well, we never pretended it was going to be a small liberal arts college.
I see.
And as you know from what I told you about the first trustees meeting, it was always intended from the time the resolution was voted that eventually it's supposed to be a university center. With complete programs, because this is where it would seem to be needed.
That issue resurfaced up periodically for as long as I could remember, and it usually came up with my involvement in kind of connection with the problem of sewers. And every time we...
Sewers, yes.
Which makes it seem like a very mundane kind of thing.
I remember that, yeah.
Really constrained the university's ability to capacity, literally capacity to expand. And periodically I would be challenged by the community on a violation of a trust that we were to be a, I think the total was 500, I think it was 500 FTE campus, and that we had violated this understanding by expansion and by creating problems for the community, and particularly in terms of sewage. So the issue of some sort of understanding that someone may or may not have made came up periodically for years afterwards.
Even as late as 4 or 5 years ago, it was still coming up. I mean, community.
I remember the whole Flush Gas Sewage Plant.
Well, in that particular project, it came up quite violently.
Hold it just a second. The first speaker was John Slocum, and the second one was Herb Gordon, and the third, Jim Ling, L-I-N-G?
L-Y-N.
L-Y-N-G. All right. Herb, what was your position?
Well, starting in 64, I was involved in land acquisition. I came on board actually as land acquisition attorney. And after about 3 months, Larry Murray called me in and told me they had been looking for a director of university land acquisition.